So we're going to be looking at past, present, and future lives. Who are we, who were we, and who will we be? Okay, this presentation is based on the teachings of A.C. Bhaktivinoda Swami Prabhupada, who is my guru. So our most basic question should be, maybe isn't always, but should be, who am I? Do you know that when we make decisions in life, we don't make decisions by a cost-benefit analysis? We don't sit down and say, well, let's see, if I do this, these good things will happen and these bad things will happen and kind of tally it up. That's not actually how it works. We don't like to make good decisions in life, yes? Yeah? Okay. So the way we make decisions in life is based on our identity. We have an idea of who we are, and then we have an idealized self. And that idealized self, you know, I'm a good student. Okay, what does the ideal good student do? And when I'm faced with decisions, then I think, okay, the ideal good student would do this, or the ideal good student wouldn't do that. And advertising works on that principle. It actually appeals to our sense of identity. So if we have the wrong identity, we're going to make the wrong decisions. We're going to make decisions that won't really make us happy. So if we compare the Western idea of identity to the Eastern idea of identity, in general in the West, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. Before the beginning, there was nothing. After the end, there's nothing. And we think that way in terms of our own life. We even think that way in terms of the earth, in terms of the universe. But the Eastern idea is cyclical, that everything is eternal. And something like the seasons, there's a spring, summer, winter, fall. There's a spring, summer, winter, fall. And conservation of energy, like one of the things that Einstein discovered, that energy is neither created nor destroyed. It simply changes its form. All right, now how can we... I have water here somewhere. How can we prove that there's reincarnation? How can we prove that we don't just have a birth, a death, and a life, and that's it? That actually we're having birth after birth. How can we really know? Well, we would say that the only irrefutable proof, the only real proof, would be Shastra, which is a Sanskrit word for scripture. And scripture basically means the guidebook that comes along with the universe. Just like when you get a computer, or when you get a speaker, or it has an instruction manual. And the manufacturer of the device knows best how it operates. Otherwise, if you simply try to guess, we have several problems. One problem is that we have imperfect senses. Right? Isn't it a fact? We can only see certain parts of the light spectrum. We can only hear certain parts of the sound spectrum. We can't see through solid objects. We can't see around walls, etc. So we have a very limited scope for all of our senses. And of course we know there are many creatures on Earth that have greater sense perception in one or two senses than we have. I mean, there are birds who can fly up miles in the sky and see a tiny little rabbit running around, right? Or dogs that can follow a scent over a long distance. Oh, thank you. Which we cannot do, but even their senses are limited. You know, a dog can't smell anything and a bird can't see anything. So if we're going to try to find out knowledge about what happens after death, just using our senses, we're going to be limited in what we can find out. And another problem, unfortunately, is that we have a tendency to cheat. Anybody here like to say that they're 100% honest 100% of the time? Anybody want to? No? Yeah, me neither. So it's a problem. It's a problem. And who's the main person that we cheat, by the way? That's right. So there's also been a lot of studies that we perceive things based on our preconceived ideas about what we're going to perceive. You've studied this sort of thing? Do you all know about the card experiment? It's a very famous card experiment. So the researchers took a deck of regular playing cards and they added in some funny cards. They added in like red of spades, you know, and black diamond. They mixed them in with the cards and they showed the subjects the cards very quickly and asked them what kind of a card it was. So being shown very fast, people would look at the cards and just say that it was, they'd see, you know, a red spade and they'd either say it was a heart or it was a spade. And they'd gradually slow down the showing of the cards, and at a certain point, 75% of people would say something funny. What was that card again? But 25% of people never recognize the weird cards. Why? Because they had a preconceived notion that they're looking at cards. And cards have four suits. And because they had that preconceived notion, they never saw the strange cards. So we all do that to some extent. We all perceive the world based on our internal biases and our cultural biases. We each have individual biases and we have cultural biases. And that changes. So we have imperfect senses, and then how we interpret what we get from our imperfect senses is not always honest. And we're often not even aware that we're being dishonest. We're skewing the data to fit what we want to prove. Now, sometimes we're aware that we're doing that, and other times we're cheating ourselves and we're not even aware that we're doing that. And another problem is that we have illusions. And just like we have optical illusions, we can be illusioned. And we can make mistakes. So our senses may be functioning properly, but still we make mistakes. So with these defects, how are we going to find out what's really true? Therefore, we go to the sacred literature. Of course, you can say, well, that just removes the problem one step, because how do you know what's sacred literature? Right? I'm sure many of you are thinking, well, that doesn't really help anything. Then we just end up being agnostics and saying nobody can know anything. That's the whole postmodern, post-positivistic point of view, that nobody can really know anything, and therefore what anybody decides to know, when anybody decides is true, can be true for them. Of course, what's really interesting about that concept is it's also an absolute concept. You all following me? Because the post-positivistic view is there's absolutely no absolutes. And anything that's true for you is true for you. As soon as someone says, no, there's something objective truth, no, there can't be objective truth. So it's funny that even when people try to get away from absolutes, they end up going to one, which is quite humorous. Also, frankly, the post-positivists don't really accept that anybody's view of reality is as good as anybody else's. They don't really accept that. If you say, well, you know, apartheid is just as good as any other system, or Nazism is just, they'll say, no. You know, cannibalism is just as good a diet as any other diet. Then immediately the people say, well, wait a minute, there's a boundary. So this idea that because with our senses and mind, it's impossible to know things absolutely, you can have evidence, but you can't have absolute knowledge, doesn't mean that everything's relative. You really won't find people who believe that everything is relative. So you say, okay, well, then we've got to go to Shastra. We've got to go to evidence that's beyond the senses, that comes from somebody who knows what's going on, who doesn't have these problems of imperfect senses and cheating and illusion and mistakes. Now, how do we tell that Shastra is actually Shastra? Well, there's a number of ways that we can tell, and again, you're going to argue that all of these ways are also subject to somewhat of interpretation. One is that the Shastra has been passed down from teacher to disciple since the beginning of time. Now, again, you can say, well, that requires some faith. I mean, how do I know? All I know is what's happened in my own lifetime. But in this respect, then you say we can't trust any sort of human history. How can we really know that any recorded history is absolutely factual? And again, you're stuck in this place that, well, then nobody can know anything. And again, you can't live like that. So one evidence is that things have been passed down from generation to generation. But perhaps the greatest proof that something is actually Shastra is that it gives you the results that it promises. So the real proof of Shastra is given, for example, in the Bhagavad Gita, which is what we're going to look at here, as for discussion of reincarnation as a soul, where there it is said that real knowledge, Raja Vidya, Raja means king, Vidya means knowledge, Raja Vidya, Raja Guyam, that the king of knowledge is also the king of secrets. Pavitram, it's most pure. Pratyaksha agamam dharmam. Pratyaksha means you directly experience it. Susukam, it makes you very, very happy. So if something is genuine scripture, it gives you truths that you can directly experience, and those truths will bring you joy. So I remember when I was first reading the Bhagavad Gita when I was in university, I was foolishly wasting my time arguing with one of my professors about how that truth is beautiful. And he says, no, a lot of truth is ugly. And I said, no, actually, if you see total truth, it must be beautiful. It must bring you joy. So that's the ultimate proof that you're dealing with Shastra. So what does it say in the Bhagavad Gita about the nature of the soul and the existence of reincarnation? So this is one verse. This is the Sanskrit. Dehino smenyata dehe komaram yovanam jarat tata dehantara pratir diras tatranamuyate, which means that just as we pass from one body to another in this life, in the same way we will pass to another body at death. Now that's something, that's again pratyaksha, that's something you can observe. So everyone here is older than two, yes? So if we found the photographs of when everybody here was two, and we put the photographs on the wall, and we said match, could we do it? It would be a challenge, wouldn't it? Yes, be very difficult. And frankly, looks like most of you are considerably younger than I am, but I hate to tell you this. I don't know if I should tell you this or not, but when we're all 80, we're not going to look the way we look now. And not only will we not look the way we look now, but if we had, you know, the 2-year-old pictures, the 22-year-old pictures, and the 82-year-old pictures, you wouldn't be able to match them up either. You ever, like, looked at pictures of your grandparents when they were really young, when they got married or something like that? You're like, whoa, they don't look like the same person. So the body's changed, and it's not just like you took the 2-year-old body and pumped air into it like a balloon and it just got bigger and bigger. It's a different body. Right? The cells are always changing. By every 7 years, every cell in our body has been replaced. It's a different body. So even in this life, in one sense, you can say that we have reincarnated from one body to another. And our mind's also changed, hasn't it? Yet we're the same person. We have a continuing sense of identity. I mean, I can remember I can remember listening to my mother when I was about 1.5, and I can remember something I said to my mother when I was 4. So I have a continuing sense of identity, even though the body has changed. So this is one evidence given in Bhagavad Gita for reincarnation. Here's another verse. Vasamsi jirnani yata vahaya navani grihanati naro parani tata sarirani vahaya jirnani anyani samyati navani dehi. Dehi means body. And the translation for that is, just like we put on new garments, giving up old ones, similarly we accept new material bodies, giving up the old and useless ones. So here's an analogy. When my clothes get old, I get rid of them. I get new clothes. Even when my clothes get dirty, I change them for clean clothes. But I'm still the same person. So the body is really like a set of clothes. And here you see a little, right? Here's this guy, so baby, and then boy, and then youth, and old man, and death, and taking birth as a baby, then a little girl, and youth, and etc., and then death again, and just like changing different sets of clothes. And here's another verse. Najayate miyate vakadachin, Nayam Bhutva Bhavitava Nabuyaha Ajo Nacheshvato Yam Purano Nahanyate Hanyamane Shivire. For the soul, there's neither birth nor death at any time. He is unborn, eternal, ever-existing, and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. So not only does the soul not die, but the soul is never born. That we, the soul, have always existed and will always exist. So what's again our prajaksha? What's our empirical evidence? Who here has ever seen somebody die? Anybody here seen somebody die? Anybody seen an animal die? Okay. So I watched a cat die, and I also watched my mother die. There's a story, true story, of a man in America who used to work for the government wildlife section. Well, what that meant was he went out in areas where there were farmers, and he would trap and kill predator animals like mountain lions, etc. And one time he was out checking the traps with his 10-year-old son. And they came upon a mountain lion that was caught in the trap but not dead. And as they watched, the mountain lion died. And the boy looked at his father and said, "Why did the light go out in his eyes?" At which time the father had kind of a change of heart and gave up his profession and started working for the good of the predator animals. But you can see, if you're there when some living being dies, that the body is still there. There's a subtle change that you notice, but the whole body is still there. All the chemicals of the body is still there. You know, when my mother died, my mother's body was lying in the bed. But yet my mother was gone. Obviously, the person I called my mother was different than the body, because the body was still there. Make sense? Body was still there. Now, one particular argument that really convinced me, I guess at the time I was 17, was when I was reading one example that also when we're in the womb. So I'm the same person that was in my mother's womb, but in my mother's womb, my body was gradually forming. First, it was just one cell, but still I was there. It's not that I entered into the body at birth or at a certain point in gestation. But yet first, and you've seen pictures, right, of the embryo and the fetus in the womb. I mean, the body doesn't even look, first it doesn't look like much of a body at all. It's just one cell, and then it becomes a blastocyte and just a group of cells, just kind of a globby thing. But still, I was there. So obviously, I have an existence that's different from the body. I exist when the body is hardly formed. I exist through the changes of the body. And then when the body's there at the end, when you say, Urmila's died, my body's going to be there, but I won't be there. So this is prajaksha. This is things we can directly experience, where we can see there's some difference between myself and the body. So the descriptions given in Shastra and Bhagavad Gita of the soul is that the soul is that we, the soul, not that we have a soul, that is us, I am a soul, you are a soul, we are each a soul, every living being is a soul. That the soul is indestructible, eternal, that is full of knowledge and full of happiness, that is controlling the body from the region of the heart, that is materially inconceivable, that it changes bodies, that is very small, and that it's individual, that the soul has personality. So the body is really just like a machine. You like that? Isn't that a cool painting? A good friend of mine did that. Actually, a lot of the illustrations were done by her. So the body is a machine, and we're driving the machine around. And also, inside the body is what we call the super soul. So there's myself, the soul, and then there's the oversoul, or the super soul. The super soul is really the soul of the whole universe, who's also there within every living being's body. And again, as soon as something is alive, then it's a soul. So whether it's a spider, whether it's a dog, whether it's a bird, whether it's a tree, all are souls. Life, if there's life, there must be a soul. So just like this chair, there's no soul. It's not alive. Anything that's alive means there's a soul. All right, and then it gets a little bit more complicated. So there's the self, the soul, and then there's the body, but then there's also what we call the subtle body. The subtle body is made up of our false ego, I am part of this world, and our mind and our intelligence. And the subtle body is what we travel in from one body to another. Now, for example, when people see ghosts, what they're seeing is the subtle body. What person becomes a ghost when somehow they get stuck, like a lift becomes stuck between floors. So somehow when the body dies, if the person, and there's various reasons people get stuck, if somehow the person gets stuck and doesn't go on to their next destination, they can hover as a ghost. And a ghost means simply that they're the soul inside of a subtle body without going on to another gross body. Okay, now this next video, it's a little technical. It was made by another disciple of my guru, who was, he's not living anymore, but he had a PhD in mathematics from Cornell University. He was a very advanced scientist. And he's going to explain a little bit about the relationship between the mind and the brain. Now, it's a very long video, and we've just taken a little piece of it, so it will appear to sort of cut off in the middle, because it does cut off in the middle, because we didn't use the whole thing. So I hope you can follow. It is a little technical, but I hope you can follow this.
To see how a theory of mind-brain interaction might be formulated, it is useful to examine the Sankhya philosophy of India. According to this philosophical system, a living being consists of three components: the gross material body, the subtle material body, and the Atma, or conscious self. According to the Sankhya philosophy, gross matter consists of a series of transformations of ether, or akash, which is regarded as the substance of space. These transformations generate air, fire, water, and earth, which represent the sum total of the material elements as we know them. This theory is reminiscent of the theory of geometrodynamics based on general relativity, in which an attempt is made to represent all matter as patterns of deformation in the underlying metric of space-time. According to the Sankhya philosophy, the subtle body is made up of the elements called mind, intelligence, and false ego. These elements are material in the sense that they lack consciousness. They can be thought of as a kind of material energy that is more subtle than ether or space, and that can be molded, perhaps in a computer-like fashion, to represent ideas and patterns of thought. The energy of false ego is molded to represent the software for the false material self-identification of the conscious being. Beyond the false ego is the Atma, or the self proper, which is endowed with consciousness. We speak of the Atma as non-material, since we use the absence or presence of consciousness to distinguish between material and non-material entities. The interactive link between the Atma and the false ego is very subtle and is far removed from the domain of empirical science as we know it today. However, the link between the subtle mind and the gross physical brain may be amenable to scientific study. According to the Sankhya philosophy, the element of ether is the intermediate link between the gross body and the subtle mind. The mind generates wave patterns in the ether, which we may think of as the fabric of space. These patterns are amplified by material interactions, and they result in systematic changes in neural activity that enable the mind to direct brain activities. The neural activity of the brain also creates disturbances in the fabric of space, which influence the mind element and thereby allow for sense perception. it is perfectly possible for wave patterns to emerge from the subatomic background noise and coalesce to produce macroscopic organized patterns. Here we see a simple model of a medium that can propagate waves. This medium propagates waves according to the classical wave equation. If the proper input wave is introduced into this system, the result is the production of two organized patterns, first a letter A, and then the symbol ohm. To produce organized patterns, the key requirement is for the initial disturbances to be properly organized. The disturbances can start at arbitrarily small magnitudes and be brought to a macroscopic magnitude by natural amplification processes. For example, here is a model in which elastically colliding disks represent molecules in a gas. We see disks of two colors colliding chaotically, starting with a random initial arrangement. Now let us go back to the initial arrangement and systematically change the directions of motion of the disks by amounts so small that they would be impossible to measure. Now the disks quickly form an organized pattern. This involves effects of exponential amplification that are studied in the theory of deterministic chaos. This shows that mind-body interactions may produce macroscopic effects without a need for measurable disturbances in the dynamics of brain molecules. These interactions should produce changes in the entropy and information content of the brain, however, since they involve the transmission of information from the mind to the brain. This brings us to our last topic, the question of whether or not there is any direct evidence for mind-brain interaction. The answer is that such evidence does exist. Some evidence for this comes from modern medical science. Physicians often encounter reports of out-of-body experiences. These typically occur during heart attacks, automobile accidents, and other traumatic events. Many people have reported observing their own body from a vantage point above it while being resuscitated from car...
As I said, it stops the mill. Okay, so it's a little bit of a complex explanation of how the subtle body or the mind interacts with the gross body or the brain. And then, of course, ending with this evidence for the existence of the subtle body in out-of-body experiences.
Sure.
Was that a little much?
Yeah,
that was a little much, okay. Yes? Do any of you know anyone who's had an out-of-body experience? Okay. So in such a situation, the person is seeing their own body. Right? And sometimes when that happens, they get very confused. They think, boy, that guy there is in really bad shape. Or sometimes they're very detached. Sometimes they realize it's their body and they're like, oh, who cares about that anymore? So what the person is floating in the subtle body of mind. Okay, so the soul is not simply something formless. Actually, it's the soul, the spirit, that gives form to matter. I mean, even if you think about our normal everyday life, a living being takes dead matter and makes it into a form. In the same way, because we, the soul, are in the body has form, it has action. When we die, the body... When we leave the body, when the soul leaves the body disintegrates and loses its form. So all the different forms of all different kinds of life are actually made possible because the soul has form and personality. Now that's not to say there's not like a fish soul and there's a bird soul. The reason that there's different forms of bodies is that there's different forms of the subtle body. There's different forms of the mind. Get to that in a minute. Okay, now it's not only that the Bhagavad Gita speaks of reincarnation. Jesus Christ talked about how the prophet Elijah had again taken birth as John the Baptist. And in early Christianity, there was widespread belief in reincarnation. Right? It's the same we'll find in some of the aspects of the Quran and in some of the mystical books of Judaism. Of course, what's happened in most of these religious systems is that the teaching of reincarnation is no longer being done to the general public. And like in the case of Christianity, the church made a decision, well, we're not going to teach about reincarnation anymore. Anyone who teaches about it is going to be excommunicated. And of course, there's been famous personalities who believed in reincarnation. Here's some of them. There was General Patton in World War II, who remembered fighting on many battlefields. Great philosophers. All right, now if we accept the idea that we're different from the body and that we're moving from one body to another, what is it that decides what body we're going to get? Like we saw that slide of all the different forms of bodies. So it's basically two things, karma and desire, which are very interrelated. Basically, what you want and what you do based on what you want. So it's not just desire. Like if you say, I want to be a medical doctor, and you just hang around watching TV, it's not really much of a desire. So desire as evidenced by action. The karma literally means action. And there's actually three categories of action. There's karma, which means basically good things you do. Vikarma, bad things you do. Akarma, things you do that are neither good nor bad, but on the spiritual platform. So vikarma and karma get us material bodies, and akarma does not get us a material body. So karma will get you a nice material body, vikarma will get you a not nice material body. Most people do some vikarma mixed with some karma. So we have a mix of nice and not nice things in our life. And akarma gets you your... Well, we'll talk about that later. Okay, karma and reincarnation. For every action, there's a reaction. As you sow, so shall you reap. So we, by our karma, by our desires, we create our own fortune. So, killing a cow and then taking birth as a cow and being killed. Now, how this works, again, has to do with the subtle body. So, the subtle body, the mind, has shape. Yes? Otherwise, people wouldn't be able to see ghosts. It has shape. And it's made up of our desires, our thoughts, and our feelings. And if those desires and thoughts and feelings are a particular nature, we get a body that corresponds to that nature. Basically, what the law of karma means is I have a particular set of desires, I act according to those desires, and then I get what I want. The Sanskrit for that is eko bahunam yo vidadati kaman. Basically, we're getting whatever we want. It's just that most of us are not particularly knowledgeable to know what to want. But we really are getting whatever we want. Now, of course, there's some people who say you can just sort of sit down and just desire an I want, I want, I want, I want, and it just sort of, there it is in your hand. Most of us really aren't quite that powerful, although you can try it. But it's what we want as evidence to what we do. It's what we want is evidence to what we do. It's not just wanting and it's not just doing. It's a combination of wanting and doing. But we do create our own reality. What we have in this particular body, what we see in the mirror, the kind of family we've taken birth in, the circumstances of our life, we've created that in this life and in previous lives by our desires as evidenced by our actions. Right? Then everybody can say, what a beautiful naked tree. cosmic agents of justice. Of course, also according to our desire. If people don't take advantage of being a human being, that means they don't want to be a human being. Does that make sense to everybody? We get what we want. Again, we may not believe that because we are not really in touch with how foolish some of our wants are, but we get what we want. So if we want to live a life of a particular way, then we get the corresponding body. We should also say that there are bodies besides, according to Bhagavad Gita, there are bodies besides what we see on this planet. So there are bodies on other planets that are higher than human beings. And just like in our next life, we can take a human body. And there's, of course, varieties of human body, varieties of human life. Some people's lives are a lot nicer than others, yeah, right? And then there's the various degrees of animal lives that one can take. There's also lives on other planets that are much higher. There's entities who have all kinds of powers. They can fly in outer space without a spaceship, and they can create things just by the power of their mind and so forth. And one can get those higher bodies also by cultivating higher desires. Now, again, we're going to look at prachaksha. So are there some people who can remember past lives? So, of course, there's many, many documented histories of people who can remember their past lives. So some of these are given in the Shastra, and some of them are in modern times. So we're going to look first at some given in the Shastra. This is a story of a great king. Maharaj means king. Raja means king. Maha means great. His name was Bharat. So Bharat, after he abdicated the throne to his successor, he went to the forest in order to meditate. And unfortunately, he didn't fully give up the ego of being the king. Now, a good king, which is very hard for us to think about, what is a good king? Because in modern human history, we haven't had very many good kings. But an actual good king, or good government, again, I think most governments today are corrupt, more corrupt, most corrupt. Well, right? If you go from a most corrupt government to a corrupt government, you feel great. So we don't have much experience in the modern world of a government that really deeply takes care of its citizens. Would you agree? Yes? So maybe a little hard for us to understand this. But in this history, Bharat was actually a righteous king, and his mood was that of protecting the citizens, not only the human citizens, but the animal citizens, the plant citizens, the earth itself. But in those days, the king, as soon as he had a successor, he gave up the kingdom. He wasn't trying to stay as long as possible, and he engaged in meditation. And when he was there meditating in the woods, he saw a pregnant deer who, upon being scared by a lion, had a premature birth and then died, leaving the young fawn without any care. And in this mood of being the king, although he had supposedly given up the kingdom, in this mood of being the king, he thought, I have to protect the citizens. And that was very nice that he wanted to take care of the baby deer, but he got completely infatuated by the deer. And being infatuated by the deer, when he died, his thoughts were absorbed in that of the deer, and therefore he took the body of a deer. Now, what was particularly interesting is that in this body of a deer, he could remember that he had been a human in his previous life. He could remember that he was the great King Bharat, who had almost become a saintly person, who was meditating to become a saintly person. So as a deer, he hung around hermitages of sages. And then in his next life, he was again human, and in that human life, he actually became self-realized. In that human life, he could also remember. He could remember his life as a deer, and he could remember his life as the king. Another story, also involving an animal, is that of Gajendra the elephant. So there's a story of an elephant that was attacked by a crocodile. And although it was an elephant, he was able to remember mantras. And he was, by saying these mantras, he revived his memory of his past life, and he attained perfection. So in his previous life, he'd also been a king who had gone to the forest to meditate, Indrajumna. And being in a state of trance, he did not receive another sage, who then was offended and said, "You will become an elephant." But as an elephant, he could remember, "Oh, in my last life, I was a king trying to become a sage." Very similar story to Bharat, except in this case, it was due to really sort of happenstance rather than his own attachment. And then Krishna came to save him, and he regained his spiritual form and no longer took another birth. But he could remember his previous life. And here you see the elephant regaining his spiritual body. And here's another story. Narada Muni, who you, if you're familiar at all with Eastern tradition, you may know about. So he's a fully self-realized, liberated personality in a spiritual form. He does not have a material body. And he can travel throughout the material universe and also through the spiritual world, absorbed in transcendental bliss. But he can remember his life on earth before he appeared in his self-realized form. So he remembers that he was the son of a very poor servant. He never knew his father, and his mother was very poor. And when it was raining, some saintly persons came to stay at his house. And he would feed them, and with their permission, he ate some of their leftover food. Now, one of a very powerful spiritual process is to eat some of the food left by a saintly person. And that's what Narada in his previous life did. Then after 4 months, they also gave him spiritual instruction. They initiated him into the chanting of mantras. Then they left the hut after the 4 months of the rainy season. India has a 4 month rainy season when the roads are generally impassable. Like in Mumbai, they close the schools for rain days. Then one day after the sages left, his mother was bitten by a snake, and little five-year-old was left an orphan. So he left home. This is the story he remembers of his previous life. He's telling the story. Passes through the forest. And he chants the mantra that he was taught by the saintly persons and engages in meditation. At which point he sees the Supreme in his own heart. And he became self-realized. Traveled to many holy places. And then he also remembers his death, at which point he assumed his transcendent form of Narada. So as Narada, he recounts this story of his remembrance of his previous birth. And here's another one in the Shastra, a lizard that was saved by Krishna, who remembers that in his previous birth, he had been a king. We got a lot of king stories here. He remembers that he had been a king, and he had made a mistake, that he had given some cows away, and then one of the cows came back and gave it away again. And because of that mistake, he took birth as a lizard. Here's a modern case.
India Henderson, a housewife who had never been out of Australia, revealed a past life as an 18th century Frenchwoman, Emily de Chaville. Under hypnosis, she could suddenly understand and speak the colloquial French of the Normandy area.
Excusez-moi, chambre et j'inscris un portrait de vous.
She was able to give precise directions to the cathedral in which she had been married.
The big road goes between Rouen and Saint Michel.
Under trance, she had described in detail the exterior and interior of the cathedral. To the surprise of the independent observer, Mr. Antoine Le Breton, her descriptions were extraordinarily accurate.
I'm going to skip this one. That's another very similar one of somebody who remembered their past life and they were able to document their remembrance. Okay, there's also Ian Stevenson, who you may have heard of, who did research particularly with not remembrances of past life under hypnosis, but spontaneous remembrances. Now, spontaneous remembrances generally happen in children. Often by the time the children are 6 or 7, they start to fade. And there's some more current ones I don't have in this. There was one current one in America of a little boy who remembered being killed in World War II. You heard about that? Yeah. So in this one, she was able to remember where they buried the money in the previous house. Yeah, that's pretty cool, huh? You like that one, huh? Okay. Here's another case, being able to remember all the details of the past family, how they died, which was again verified by other persons. So she reminded her husband that they'd stolen 1,200 rupees from the box. So how is it possible to remember past births? So again, we talked about that there's a super soul. So the super soul reminds us. Actually, the super soul is reminding all of us of what we wanted in the past. And oh, here's your opportunity to get it. But in some cases, a person can remember very specifically. Okay, and here's what my spiritual master has said, that a human being must be educated to understand his past life, how he can endeavor for a better life in the future. That there's a book called the Bhrigu Samhita, which reveals information about one's past, present, and future lives. That somehow or other one must be enlightened about his past, present, and future. So here we see an artistic rendering of the concept, how we're changing bodies in this life, and then going into another body and going from human to animal forms and back to human. All right, now we were talking before about akarma. So there is a kind of work and a kind of desire that does not bring you back to another material body. That is called akarma. Akarma is actions and desires that are not material. A means not, like unkarma. So there's still actions. It's not that you're not doing anything, but the things you're doing are not generating material reactions. One could say what you're doing is generating spiritual reactions. Basically, through akarma, you dissolve the subtle body of material desire, and you awaken the spiritual body. You can think of it like if you buy a packet of seeds. You've seen the little packets of seeds at the shop. Let's say you didn't take the seeds out of the packet, you just took the whole packet and stuck it in water. So the water would dissolve the packet and sprout the seeds. So akarma does that. That's exactly what akarma does. It dissolves this subtle body, which is not us, it's a machine, just like the gross body is a machine. It dissolves that subtle machine, which is what's pushing us from one body to another. And it awakens the Atma. It awakens the real self. And the real self is full of joy. The real self, as we said in the beginning, has no birth or death. and is free from all of the difficulties. We talked about those defects, imperfect senses, and cheating and so forth, is free from all of that of the material world. And there we have the spiritual world, full of the perfection of the relationships in this world. So in this world, we have so many relationships, people that we respect, people we serve, our romantic relationships, friendly relationships, caring, mentoring relationships. So all of those exist in an eternal, supreme form of the spiritual self. So what are our practices to develop akarma, to get free of this cycle of reincarnation? So particularly this kirtan. Now, why this kirtan? Actually, the word Krishna means absolute reality in male form, Hare, Krishna and Rama in male form, Hare, absolute reality in female form. And the Sanskrit language changes when there's direct address. So in English, if your name's John, you say John went to the store, and you also say, hey, John. But in Sanskrit, it's not like that. So if Krishna does something, it's Krishnaha. If it's Krishna's, it's Krishnasya. If you give something to Krishna, it's Krishnam. And if you're talking to Krishna, it's Krishna. So the Hare Krishna mantra is ourselves talking, ourselves having a conversation, a linking, a yoga with the Supreme in male and female form. That we're, by chanting this mantra, we enter into the supreme bliss of ultimate union. And to read the shastras, which gives us information about who am I, how do I become entangled, how do I become unentangled, how does one take birth in this world, how does one get free from this world, how can one live in this world, happily in the world, and yet also above the world. And to spend time with other saintly persons. You know, whatever we want to do in this world, if we spend time with other people who are so inclined, that will help us. So in the same way, if we want to perform akarma, it's very helpful to be with other people who are also on a similar path. So thank you very much. We can have some lights. Yes. If there's any questions? How much time do we have for a discussion? 10 minutes, is that all right? Any questions or comments? Yes?
I was wondering if you could say anything about the fact that all the reincarnation stories mentioned in the scriptures are all about people being reincarnated as animals. Whereas all the ones mentioned from, like, current stories is people being reincarnated as people.
Oh, not all the ones from the scriptures. Narada Muni was a person. He was a human to a human. So not all of them. Do you have some others of humans to human in the Shastra? And, of course, Bharat went human, animal, human.
Yeah, but, like, in terms of...
But just human, human.
Modern stories of reincarnation.
They tend to be mostly human, human.
Yeah, we don't have stories.
Yeah, we do have some. I don't have it at my fingertips. I used to have, when I ran a school in America, I used to have a library of 4,000 books. Yeah, I'm a kind of a book person. But just a little bit, right? Now I just have a little electronic reader. I haven't yet put 4,000 books on it. But... there's actually quite a few stories of people who remember animal births. Now, it's not as common for people to remember animal births. I'm not sure exactly why. Maybe because the consciousness in an animal body is so radically different. I don't know. But there are certainly people who have spontaneous memories of animal births. And there are people also who remember animal births through hypnosis. So that is also there. That's a very good question. Trying to think of if there's more examples in the Shastra of human-human. Oh, there's one in the Mahabharata of Shikhandi, where Shikhandi was first Amba, who felt that Bhishma had insulted her, and so she took a vow that she was going to kill Bhishma, and she performed great austerities that she would get the power to kill Bhishma, and then she took birth as Shikhandi. And as Shikhandi, he remembered, Shikhandi was a warrior who was, he didn't directly kill Bhishma, but he was indirectly responsible for Bhishma's death. And he remembered that he was Amba. Actually, even Bhishma recognized him. Which is why Shikhandi ended up being indirectly responsible for Bhishma's death. Because Bhishma says, wait a minute, that's not a warrior, that's Amba. I'm not going to fight him. And therefore Bhishma was able to be defeated. Thinking through some other examples. There's Devaki and Vasudev. Remember being, actually not humans, they remember being demigods, higher entities on higher planets. Kasyapa and Aditi. And then going from there to being human. So there's some other examples. Yeah, I could add that to the, I should add that. Yeah. Make it more balanced. Yes?
Can you perhaps mention a bit about destiny and free will? Because it seems that if you're living out your karma, then you don't kind of have, you're living out the reactions of your previous life. So where does your free will fit in, or where does...
Okay, so let's say you buy a ticket to Joburg and you're on the plane. What's your free will on the plane? You know, you can be nice to the other passengers, you can not be nice to the other passengers. You can drink juice, you can drink alcohol, you can sleep, you can read the stupid magazine in the seat pocket, you can bring your own book to read, right? But pretty hard to get off the plane. And pretty hard to say, you know, I decided I want to go to Durban. Now, you can go to Durban after you've gotten off at Joburg, you can get on the plane to Durban. But while you're on the plane, your free will is constrained. But your free will is constrained by your own choice. You got on the plane. So free will and destiny is very intertwined like that. I mean, even in this life we see that. I make a choice in this life, and that choice then constrains my future choices. I can make future choices within that choice. So I have free will, but my every act of will puts me in a situation which then restricts, I have to go from there. Is that clear? I want to go here. Okay, but once I'm over here, I have to go from over here. I can't go from over here anymore. Now I have to start from over there. And where I can go from over there may be different from where I can go from over here. So we're creating our destiny. And some of our destiny is created from our past lives, and some of our destiny we're creating in this life. It's not that everything is past life. And certain parts of our destiny are more malleable than others. You know, certain decisions you make in life, even in this life, have a lot more permanent effect than others. You know, if you decide to eat too much for lunch, that effect is temporary. If you decide to have a baby, that affects you for the rest of your life. Does that make sense to everybody? You know, so there are certain decisions from past lives and from this life that have very short effects, and certain decisions that have very long effects. And certain decisions you make and then you can modify them, and certain are more difficult to modify. So there are certain things that once you decide them, they play out. And you can't, you know, like if you decide to get on a plane, that plays out. I mean, unless something very unusual happens, like the plane gets hijacked or it crashes or it has some mechanical failure and turns around and lands someplace else. But in the normal course of events, once you get on that plane, it plays out to the destination. You just can't decide anymore until you land that you're going to do something else. Now, you still have some freedom on the plane. And then there are other decisions that you can make and change them 5 minutes into the decision. If you just get in a car instead of a plane, you're going to drive to Joburg, then you can change that decision without having to get there first. So there's different kinds of destiny. Certain actions produce a reaction that's just, there it is. And you can't really make a big change until that plays out. And other kinds of actions have a shorter duration, and you can make some adjustment to that. But in every case, we are creating our destiny. So the destiny that's constraining us is of our own creation. Now, we can always, at any time, get out of the whole business. So there's no decision one can make that doesn't allow you to get out of the whole business, although some decisions make it harder than others. So if we make decisions that get us into an animal body, it's very hard for an animal, not impossible, but very hard for an animal to become self-realized. It's hard for the soul in the body of an animal to become self-realized. It's possible, but it's very difficult. So if one makes that kind of decision, you may really be stuck until you get back into a human form. Yes?
Could you describe what happens when you reunite with Krishna?
Well, first of all, that's not just experienced after the death of this body, but that can be experienced now, as in right now. Depending on, it really, that's just a question of how much you want it. Now, again, that sounds very simple. Well, I want it. But again, what we want is not quite so simple as saying we want it. Have we discovered that in general? Yes? Yes? Okay. So really wanting to reunite with Krishna is wanting it on a very deep level and not wanting anything else. If I want to reunite with Krishna, but I also want to have a beautiful house by the sea, with, you know. So then you may get a body on a higher planet. Well, you'll have more spiritual consciousness, but you'll also be enjoying material facility. So this, I want to say that first. So what happens when you reunite with Krishna, it's you see both yourself and Krishna simultaneously. So we have an eternal self that has an eternal form and an eternal relationship with Krishna. We become aware of who we really are. I mean, just think of how happy we are, even in this body, when we do things that really fit with who we are. You know, when you find, when you're doing some sort of activity that just, oh, that, this is, I'm really good at this. I really like this. Isn't it? It's such a wonderful feeling. Or when you're with people who just accept you for who you are. Hopefully all of us have at least one person like that in our life who knows who we are. You know, maybe we don't have zero pretenses, but very slight. The number of masks we're putting on, you know, are very small, very transparent. And they see our good qualities without thinking we're better than we are. And they see our bad qualities without thinking that we're worse than we are. And how satisfying that is when we feel, hey, I can just relax and be myself. I don't have to feel like I have to prove anything or pretend anything. So, you know, multiply that by about a billion. The idea of really getting in touch with the real self. And then, oh, this is who I am. This is where I belong. This is what I do. This is what I like. This is my personality. This is my nature. And then Krishna is the essence of all life, the sum total of all life. There was one little child earlier today, I saw he found a caterpillar and he had it in a cup with a leaf and he was just totally fascinated. And I was thinking, anything that's alive is so fascinating. But Krishna is the life of all lives. He's the essence of all lives. All other living beings are part of Krishna. So just the attraction we feel for anything that's alive, the interest, the fascination, again, multiply that billions and billions and billions of times, how attractive Krishna is. And all the beauty that there is in this world, you know, Cape Town has very beautiful features of the ocean, and the cliffs. And so I spent some time in Hawaii, and I must say Hawaii is just a little bit, no, Cape Town's much nicer. But anyway, there's a lot of beauty here, but if you take, according to the Shastra, this earth planet is the lowest of the middle planets. So like you've got a middle-class neighborhood, and just think kind of the worst possible house you could have that would still be considered middle-class. So that's what this planet is like in the whole cosmos. And yet there's so much beauty here. So all the beauty that's in the universe, again, multiply, because this is just the material universe. What to speak of the beauty that's in the spiritual reality? How beautiful Krishna is. How beautiful is his form, his fragrance, his voice, his touch. So reuniting with Krishna is one is aware of ultimate, sensory overload that goes on increasing and increasing. Now, materially, when we find pleasure in our senses, we get something called satiation. You know what satiation is? Where you go, I've had enough. And if we keep on pushing past satiation point, we get disgusted. So if you take your favorite food, you know, if you have pizza for breakfast and pizza for lunch and pizza for dinner and pizza for breakfast and pizza for lunch and pizza for dinner and pizza for breakfast and pizza, after a while you get satiated. And you go, you know, I really don't want any more pizza. But with material sense engagement, you never feel fully and completely unlimitedly satisfied. No matter how good the pizza is, you'll never say that I'm totally, all of my senses are 100% satisfied unlimitedly. You know, the best food, the best sex, the best movie, the best whatever. You don't feel this unlimited satisfaction. You feel some degree of satisfaction that has a beginning and an end. But you get satiated and you say, okay, I don't want any more. I have to take a break. And we do something in Sanskrit called bhoga tyaga, where we enjoy and then we have to stop. We enjoy and we have to stop. We enjoy it because you can't enjoy the thing again unless you get away from it. So when we reunite with Krishna, with our spiritual senses, when we and Krishna are relishing each other through spiritual senses, there's total satisfaction without satiation. So materially, there's satiation but never full satisfaction. So Mick Jagger had it right, you know. There's no real... You guys still know who he is? Okay. So there's no real satisfaction, but there's satiation. But when one reunites with Krishna, there's no satiation, but there's full satisfaction. So it's almost inconceivable to us that one can feel fully, unlimitedly satisfied, but not satiated. And therefore, one can keep getting more and more and more and more and more. So it's described when the realized soul looks at Krishna, the soul becomes more beautiful. And when Krishna looks at the soul, Krishna becomes more beautiful. And as they look at each other with love, they each become more beautiful, and it goes on increasing unlimitedly. Okay, but you don't just like stand there looking at Krishna and smelling him and touching him. But there's activities. Just like in our conditioned life, we have activities. We have variety of activities. We have variety of emotions. You know, in material life, we don't just enjoy happiness. Did you know that? Did you know we also enjoy varieties of things that are negative? Yes? Do people enjoy crying? Yes. Do people pay money to go to sad movies? Yes. Oh, it was a great movie. I loved it. Okay? Isn't that, have you ever thought that was a little strange? So we have varieties. Actually, there's considered 12 rasas or 12 tastes. And in this world, we're trying to enjoy those 12 tastes, but because we're trying to enjoy them through this machine, which is not really me, again, I get satiation but not satisfaction. So with Krishna, we actually enjoy the 12 tastes. And that means a variety of activities. So the 5 basic tastes are just awe, like the way people feel maybe when they see some famous personality, you know. You don't really do anything, you just kind of... And then there's a joy of serving a cause or serving some great person, doing something for someone that you respect as higher than yourself. Then there's the happiness of friendship, where you have exchanges but a sense of equality. And then there's the happiness of serving people who you see as subordinate to you, the happiness parents get from taking care of their children, or teachers from teaching their students, or helping someone who's in need in some way, mentoring somebody, being compassionate to someone. And then there's the happiness of romantic love. So those 5 tastes are all there between the soul and Krishna. And then there's also subordinate tastes like comedy. So Krishna loves hasya parihasya sambhasane. Krishna loves to joke. Actually, it says in the Bhagavatam that the yogi should meditate on the laughter of the Lord. So he loves to joke and laugh. And then there's also the taste of grief, of sadness. There's the taste of ghastliness, of anger. All these, again, supposedly negative things. But just like in this world, we can understand that those so-called negative things can be sources of pleasure. So on the spiritual platform, they're all actually, they're only sources of pleasure. Something like varieties of ice cream. So, could you imagine an ice cream shop that only sold vanilla? So the spiritual tastes involve varieties of happiness that could be called grief, or they could be called ghastliness, or they could be called wonder, or they could be called comedy. And we experience those in their perfection without any inebriety in various activities. So in spiritual realization, one doesn't need to do activities for some purpose. Like here, we need to do, we have to bathe and we have to eat and so forth and so on. So in self-realization, one doesn't need to do anything. So we have activities here we do that we don't need to do. And we call these pastimes, we'll say, you know, football is a pastime, it's a game. So in the spiritual realization, in union with Krishna, one is engaged in many games called lila, which means pastime, or krida, which means play. So there's activities, but they're all playful. The only goal they have is pleasure. They don't have a goal of accomplishing anything, because one no longer has a body that's subject to hunger and thirst and tiredness and things like that. So there's all the pleasures of this body, again, amplified billions of times with full satisfaction, without satiation, on a spiritual platform just for pleasure. Is that all right? Yes?
So you mentioned when you spoke about how even in this one lifetime, we see ourselves reincarnating.
Yes.
Changing from boy to youth, old age. And then you also said, but it's interesting how we have this sense of continuous identity. But it sort of feels like it's dependent on our memory. It's because I can remember that I was a little kid, mm-hmm. that I can sort of say that I was the same person. But then mm-hmm. it feels, because that's something I often get when you speak about reincarnation, and sort of feels intuitively that once that chain of memory is broken, that as an identity, it's hard to make that connection again. So even, okay, maybe the stuff I do now in the next, somebody's going to take birth, and then the reaction is going to be there. But can I really say, can I really make that connection of identity if I don't have that memory?
That's a very interesting point. It's interesting, again, I don't think very many of you here are as old as I am, but what happens is that the older you get, the further away you get from something, the more the memory becomes dreamlike. It's quite interesting. I mean, I'm sure most of us, our memories of our young childhood are kind of dreamlike. Yes? We lose a sense of specificity about them. Although when I was a kid, I was going to remember what it was like to be a kid when I was an adult. I mean, I was sure when I was a kid. I thought those adults, they just don't remember what it was like to be a kid, and they don't treat us kids nicely, and I'm going to remember. But I didn't. You know, the further away I got, the more fuzzy the memory got. Right, and I can remember, well, okay, I know at that time I got in a really big argument with that person, but I can't remember what we were arguing about. Right? Isn't that funny? And unless you keep some kind of a journal, or unless you keep some kind of photographs, things get really fuzzy. So you have sort of a general memory, and we keep it alive with stories. We tell people stories, you know, this happened, and that keeps the memory alive. I remember one of my sons saying to me, sometimes I'm not sure if I actually remember something or if my memory is just that other people told me about it and there's photographs. So even in this life, our memory of what we've done in the past is a strange thing. And the further away we get in time, the more there's a sense of unreality about it. You know, I mean, I sort of know that something happened and that I did something, but my ability to relate to it becomes more and more and more difficult. Unless I do something to keep it alive, or unless it was something very traumatic that you're either good or bad, very intense, where you kind of keep running the movie over and over again in your mind. Now, why do we forget from one life to another? Because otherwise we wouldn't be able to get our desires. You know, there's only a certain amount of things you can do in a particular body. There's certain things I can do with this body I have now. Certain things this body and mind I have now are really good at. I'm sure that's true for all of us. And certain things this body and mind I'm in now are really not very good at. And certain things certain bodies can't do. You know, certain things you can only do if you're female. Certain things you can only do if you're male. Certain things you can only do if you're a bird. And if you remembered, it would interfere with it. You know, and sometimes people have like some partial memories and it kind of messes up their lives, actually. You know, if you can't get into the mentality of the body you have right now, if you still have some, you know, in your conscious awareness, some memory of other lives, it may really mess things up. Because we have relationships with people in this life that we had relationships with in the past, they may be very different. You know, you remember, oh, I was married to this person in this life, and I mean, it may make a big mess of your life. And you may not be able to really fulfill your desires. Does that make sense to everybody? It's that for most people, if they have too clear of memories of previous life, it's a problem for them. And even they may not know it's a memory from a previous life. They may not know that that's what's causing the problem. But they just feel very different from the body that they're in. They just feel, I don't fit this body. You know, I really belong in a different kind of body. And then what are you going to do? You know, it's what are you going to do? I mean, I guess you can go to the doctor and have them chop it up and try to reform it, but it doesn't really quite make it. I mean, sometimes you find people do things like they move to another country and they adopt another culture because they're very attached to another country and another culture from their past life. Again, they may not have a clear memory of what's pushing them in that direction, but that may make it hard then to go on and do what we wanted to do in this life. Of course, it is possible to remember your previous lives, and there are many people who spontaneously remember their previous life. Many, many children spontaneously remember previous lives. Although, again, it tends to fade, because if it doesn't fade, you can't really get into the business that you wanted to do in this life. So there is evidence like that. And to say that, well, not everybody remembers, but many people do. And there are processes by which you can tap those memories. They're still there. It's not that they've gone away. They are still there. I mean, it's something like if you have an external hard drive, right? So the memory's there, but unless it's connected to your computer, you can't access it, or you have something on a flash drive. So those memories are there, but generally in this life we can't access them, but there are processes by which you can access them. And even when people access them, again, they tend to be dreamlike. Just like our memories of earlier in this life. Not necessarily. I mean, I've met people who have very sharp and clear memories of previous lives. Yes?
What's the boundary between life and not life? Is a glacier alive? Is a bacteria alive? Can we reincarnate the bacteria?
Yes, but not as a glacier.
So the difference is the self?
The difference is consciousness. Desire. So matter that has no soul within it has no desire. My computer has no desire. It doesn't care if it gets turned on or not. I mean, I was joking that it wouldn't like it if you plugged in the thing. But what I meant was that if you plug in the thing too early, it messes up the function of the computer. But it's not that it has any desire. It doesn't care. If I never turn it on again, it won't care. It won't start crying. I don't get to be on. Why haven't you talked to me for a long time? It has no desire. If I take a sledgehammer and smash it, I mean, I would care, but the computer wouldn't care. It has no desire. This chair doesn't care. It has no conscious awareness. And life cares. I mean, even a teeny, teeny, tiny bug cares whether it lives or dies. Doesn't it? It cares. If it feels threatened, it changes course. And there's even experiments done that plants care. That if you go into a room of, like a greenhouse full of plants, now, they've done these sort of experiments, and if the person is thinking, I'm going to uproot those plants, even if they don't say anything, the plants start giving out defensive chemicals, as it would do like for an insect invasion or something like that. So there's desire. The core desire of life is to live. The core desire of every living being is to exist and to live, because we're eternal. You can say, well, wait a minute, some people commit suicide, but I guarantee you, if you went up to any suicidal person and said, hey, I fix all your problems, they wouldn't want to die anymore. They're wanting to die simply because they're desperate and they're thinking that's the only way to fix their problems. But really what they'd rather is to live without problems. So the main desire of life is to live, to exist. This chair has no desire to exist as a chair. I mean, the energy will always exist in some form, but it has no desire to exist in the form of a chair. The other desire of life is for enjoyment, is for pleasure. Again, every living being is seeking for some kind of pleasure. Even if that pleasure is just, you know, to eat and to mate and like that. And also, life is always curious. Now, again, life may be curious about where to find good food or where to find a good mate, but life is curious. Those three things, eternity, bliss, and knowledge, are the signs of the soul. And everything that's alive exhibits those things. A desire to exist, a desire for happiness, and curiosity, a desire for knowledge. And in entities where consciousness is exhibited to a higher degree, then you'll also see relationship. So again, you see this even among insect species. I don't think you see this much among bacteria, although I don't know, and plants, but you certainly see it once you get to insects and fish. There's some desire for relationship. So those are the same. Again, you know, the chair has no desire for a relationship. It doesn't care if I sit in it or not. It's not like, oh, I really want someone to sit on me. I'm so lonely. It doesn't have that kind of... So a glacier doesn't have that sort of feeling. Yes?
I was just thinking that sometimes we have experiences that when we dream, we experience things that we've never actually experienced
in this life. Yeah.
And we can't understand these things, or we do things that we've never done before, or see things that we've never seen before, almost as if the memories are there.
Yes.
From previous lives.
Yes, well, Prabhupada says that that's one indication. That and dreams, sometimes things from past life will come. Well, a few months ago, I had this really interesting dream that I could fly. And I just, like, knew how to fly. It was so cool. And when I woke up, it was just effortless. Like, I don't know what I did exactly, but I could just do something, and I was flying. When I woke up, I thought I must have known how to do that in some body, because I had a sense in my dream of how to do that. So there are some residual memories of other things that do sometimes come out in dreams. Yes?
I want to come back to the whole analogy you had with the getting on an airplane and...
Oh, with the destiny and free will.
Destiny and free will. Because now, if you explain it to people, and I might have to do that tomorrow, that's why I'm asking. If you explain that to people, then they would think that, okay, what's the point then? If you can't change the certain things. So how does chanting...
Okay, first of all, there's some things you can change. Even on the airplane, there's a lot of things you can change on the airplane. Correct? Yes?
Yeah. I'm wondering how would you explain to someone that's not familiar with chanting at all, what is the effect on your karma? Or on your destiny? Does it slow it down?
Okay, you're looking at... Let's see what we really want to do. We really don't want to be chanting so that we can simply get better karma. Now, it may do that for you, and it can even adjust your karma in this life. But, you know, you can even do that without chanting. It's not that every single thing in this life is absolutely predestined. You're not predestined to eat too much at lunch today. You know, that's a decision you make today. You follow? You understand what I'm saying? That's not something that was decided 200 lifetimes ago. That's something you're deciding right now. Or you're not just, you know, wasn't decided 200 lifetimes ago whether you're going to smoke or... Do you follow? Now, you may have some proclivities from previous lives. So you may have a tendency towards being lazy or being healthy that also comes from what you've done in your previous lives. But there's a lot you can do to change your destiny even in this life. Not everything is fully predestined. Now, the one big plane that we're on in this life is this particular body. You know, there's only so much you can change the body that you're in. you know, you can dye your hair, but the roots show. And I know, how much can you do? So you can get lots of tattoos, and now people even do weird, they put like silicone horns in their head, and, you know, weird things. And, I mean, there's a certain amount you can change your body, but it's limited. You know, they haven't yet developed the plastic surgery that'll give you usable wings. You know, and they can't, sorry guys, but they can't really make men into women or women into men. Not really. They can't turn a man into a woman that can have a baby. And they can't turn a woman into a man who's actually potent. They just can't do it. You know, they can make some appearance. Now, actually, there are some stories in the scriptures of people who did change their body in this life. There's one story of Ilan Sujumna in the Bhagavatam. So that was a person who was born a woman and turned into a man and then turned to a woman and turned into a man and then went back and forth from man to woman every other month for the rest of his life.
Oh, man.
Yeah. What a story that is. Someday I'm going to write an article about that one. But now, what was interesting about that story is when she was a woman, she was fully a woman, and when she was a man, he was fully a man. And Ilan Sujumna had children both as a woman and as a man, so it was the mother of children and also the father of children. And what's really far out is at the end of that whole life, he became self-realized and didn't take birth again. So we don't have the developed science how to do that at the present time. Our science is very gross. They have subtle science. But anyway, the big plane that we're on is the particular body that we have. You know, I mean, you can somewhat change the color of your skin. You can buy bleaching creams, or you can buy tanning lotions, and you can. But there's a limit, right? You can only change within a certain boundary. So that, you know, until we're out of this body, we're in this body, and just. And if you're really upset with the body you have, all you're going to do is get another body in your next life. You know, if you're thinking, I really wish that I was darker or lighter or taller or shorter or this, and then you just, all you're doing is creating desires for another body. So that part of destiny, chanting Hare Krishna, anything you do, it's not going to change it. Now again, if we still had access to the old subtle sciences, perhaps you could change it some more, but that we do not. So generally, 99.999%, that isn't going to change. What chanting will change is your sense of identity with this body and your sense of who you are. You'll see who you really are. I mean, anybody here totally happy with their body? You know? Do any of us look in the mirror and go, perfect!
Don't take from that.
You know.
No pictures from that.
Yeah. Or any of us perfectly happy with our mind? Would any of us like to take the contents of our mind and put it on the internet? Whatever. I don't think so. So what chanting really does is it informs us, it's not me. It's not me. This body is not me. It's costume. The mind isn't me. The body and mind, they're both machines. They're machines designed to fulfill foolish desires. They're not me. It's such a relief. So even if there's some destiny that's still going to happen to your body, if you're situated as an observer, as a detached observer, you're not affected. It's just interesting. Now, by the way, you can even do that temporarily with something like hypnosis. So there are people who had surgical operations under hypnosis. Are you aware of that, without any anesthesia? I actually met a medical doctor who's allergic to anesthesia, and she told me that she had major surgery just under hypnosis. So, and I had two childbirths with just hypnosis that were completely pain-free. And in that, both of those times, I was an observer. It was a really cool experience. I could feel what was happening in my body, but I was an observer. And it was just, oh, that's interesting. Oh, that's really interesting. Oh, that's really interesting. Oh, look at that. And I didn't feel any kind of pain. It was just interesting. Now, that can be done mechanically for a short period of time. I couldn't walk around like that. I couldn't function in life like that. It was a mechanical thing. But by chanting, it's a real thing. It's the authentic thing that you wake up to who you are, and everything in life just becomes interesting. And you're experiencing your real self internally and your real activities internally. Which means that if things wonderful, so-called wonderful in the world happen, you're not swept away by them and bewildered by them, and so-called terrible things happen, you're not devastated by them, because you're always experiencing something wonderful from within. So that's the ultimate way in which chanting frees one from karma. It makes one transcendent to one's karma. It makes one realize that the karma's not me. This life we're living is something like a movie that we're watching, and we're identifying with it. We're not really living it. We're actually just watching it and identifying with it. And chanting makes you aware that you're just watching it. It's kind of like the difference between sitting down and watching the movie and walking through a shop where they're selling television sets and where they have the movies on the sets. And you just walk by and you glance at it, but you're not absorbed in it. So it gives you detachment. And not that detachment is boring. Say, well, that would be boring. I wouldn't have any more material pains. Or I wouldn't have any more material pleasures either. No, one is enjoying spiritual variety of spiritual pleasure within. And chanting frees you from your karma in that it dissolves the machine of the subtle body that pushes us from one gross body to another. So one doesn't get any more gross. It stops the whole cycle. So in that way, it also frees one from karma. Now, chanting can also change some of our destiny in this life. Now, how does that work? Because we have our destiny, again, according to our desires and our actions, various things we want to experience. But by chanting, you'll stop wanting to experience those things. And therefore, you won't. Krishna is very responsive, and he's fulfilling the desires of everyone. If you no longer have those desires, you'll no longer have those experiences. Or another way one could put this, is if you no longer need to learn the lesson, you won't learn the lesson, which is, I don't like to quite put things in that way, because that sounds more punitive. But that's also factual. So you could say the results of bad karma are lessons. But if you've already learned the lesson, just like there are some schools where you can get out of a course by taking an exam, you don't have to take the course. Do they have that in this country? So by chanting, you gain realization. And by gaining that realization, it's like you've already passed the exam. You don't need to take the course anymore. The other thing that happens when you chant is you're working directly with Krishna, and your lifetime then becomes custom designed for you. Now, that doesn't mean it's all going to be materially rosy, but it means it will all be spiritually beneficial. Whereas when you're just under the law of karma, you could say everything's good in a very indirect sense. Because you could say in a very indirect sense, everything is always good. But it's almost a bit of a stretch. It's true, but it's a very indirect, long-term kind of thing. But when you're actually in connection with Krishna, everything is immediately good. Even the things that, from a material perspective, appear very terrible. And one who's in that consciousness experiences that whatever is happening on the material platform, which isn't really happening to me, is happening for the benefit of me. So one experiences one's life very differently. Another thing that chanting does is it helps you to make better decisions, because it clears your consciousness. It's kind of like driving if your windshield's all foggy. How are you going to know what road to take? How are you going to know if you're on the road? And if your windshield's clear, then you can make proper decisions. So chanting clears our consciousness. So for the things that we're deciding in this life, which is a vast majority of what we're deciding, by the way, a lot of what's happening to us is based on decisions we're making now. And our ability to make good decisions now, to make decisions that will actually be for our happiness, is greatly enhanced by chanting. Is that all right? But it's not that, you know, if you chant Hare Krishna, all of a sudden you're going to look in the mirror and your nose isn't crooked anymore. And, you know, you finally have the curly hair you always wanted or something like that. All of a sudden you can fly. Anything else? Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay.